Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
News from the Middle East that could pave the way for an historic agreement, a new plan between the Hamas and Fatah movements that would implicitly recognize the State of Israel, something the newly elected Hamas government has refused to do. The potential agreement comes as tensions between the two groups have increased following the weekend kidnapping of an Israeli soldier and the deaths of two other soldiers during a raid in which Hamas participated. And reports of the agreement came before a car explosion in Gaza City today near Abbas's home. We spoke to Boston Globe correspondent Anne Barnard just as the car bomb was reported and as she made her way to the site. We asked her what was expected to be included in the new agreement.
Hamas and Fatah negotiators have agreed on something called the prisoners' document. This is a proposal put forward by prisoners in Israeli jails from both of the factions. And they've been struggling over this for weeks now, and today they've finally agreed on the document. The main points are agreeing on the goal of a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, the areas that Israel occupied in 1967. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has suggested through aides that this would be an implicit recognition of Israel by Hamas. But we just met with a Hamas spokesman who said that it means nothing of the kind. So there's already going to be ambiguity in the way both sides interpret this document. The other main points are focusing armed violence against Israel in the territories, in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, and not within the State of Israel. Again, the wording here doesn't say that it's limited to the territories. It says that resistance, as they call it, will be focused on the territories. And as we know, Hamas and other militant groups carried out an attack inside Israel just 2 days ago. The third point is accepting a peace plan proposed by Saudi Arabia and other Arab states under which the Arab world would recognize Israel if Israel returned to the 1967 borders. But again, Israel is not likely to ever do that. They've said that there are certain settlements in the West Bank that they plan to make part of Israel forever. So the main significance of this document is actually that there's something of an agreement between Hamas and Fatah, not that it would expect it to produce a breakthrough between the Palestinians and Israel.
We're wondering, too, about divisions within Hamas. You say that this might be a breakthrough between Fatah and Hamas, but Hamas is fractured between the Palestinian president there and the man in Damascus, Syria, who's said to actually be the guiding hand behind Hamas and is said to be much more militant. So how is he expected to react to this plan?
Well, officially, Hamas spokesmen say Hamas is one movement, and if Hamas agrees to the document, it means that all of Hamas agrees. But in practice, we've seen a growing split in Hamas over the last few days. It's clear that the Hamas members that are part of the government were caught by surprise, or at least say they were caught by surprise, by the kidnapping, by the capture of this Israeli soldier. And they've been at least open to talk to try to release him, and they've called for his well-being, whereas the militant wing carried out the attack, perhaps at the behest of Khalid Mashal, the hardline leader of Hamas, who's based in Damascus. Some people see the signing of this document as a way for the more moderate factions within Hamas to strike back and say, we are here within Gaza and the West Bank. We need to make some more pragmatic decisions.
Just want to make sure listeners heard you. You're in the thick of this, the aftermath of this bombing. You mentioned the exiled Hamas leader Khaled Mashal, who again lives in Damascus, Syria, and is said to, you know, really be the fellow who's in command of the military wing of Hamas. You mentioned the soldier, Anne. Is there any news of the kidnapped Israeli soldier?
Israeli troops are massed at the border. They may carry out a rescue operation or an invasion of Gaza if the situation is not resolved. But it seems that there's no new news today. Hamas government spokespeople have said that he is alive.
And, of course, now we have this car bombing in Gaza, a car destroyed in a Gaza City explosion. Too soon to tell exactly what happened there, but no doubt it will have some impact on these talks that you're talking about.
Well, it's hard to say. Israel is denying any involvement, and it may be some kind of internal attack between the factions or some kind of accident. Just arriving at the scene now, and there's a crowd and some police cars, so we'll find out more about it.
That's Boston Globe correspondent Anne Barnard speaking to us from Gaza. Anne, please be safe and thank you.
Thank you.
Well, turning to New York now, where nearly 5 years after 9/11, plans for a breathtaking memorial at the World Trade Center site are mired in a battle of wills. The original plan for the site was designed by unknown architect Michael Arad and chosen from thousands of entries in 2004. Last week, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg and Governor George Pataki unveiled a dramatically scaled-back plan and announced a week of public comment. Well, there's been plenty, and we'll speak to an architectural critic in a moment, but first, Arun Venugopal is a reporter with WNYC in New York City. And Arun, this project was originally projected to cost $350 million. Politicians balked when the price ballooned to nearly $1 billion, and they called for this new scaled-back design. So first, how did the price get up so high?
One of the things that really inflated the cost in the vicinity of $300 to $400 million is infrastructure. A lot of things that are happening underground. You have to understand that the memorial is just part of the overall, the master plan here at Ground Zero. And so there are a lot of things that are interconnected, and it's very difficult for them to pull it off. So basically what Frank Siame, who's been entrusted with cutting costs for the memorial, what he's done is try to figure out how those can be reduced, those infrastructure costs. And I think that's one of the major things that has been changed recently.
Well, we understand that victims' families did not like the first plan at all because it involved a descent underground. We're going to learn more about that from a critic in a moment. But there's a lot of controversy about the new design, and it's around the names and the names of victims and how they might be placed. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. Well, you have different categories of victims' families. But one thing that they agree on is the fact that the names, although they've now been made above ground, so you can approach it while you're just coming off the street, but they still are randomly ordered. That is, they want to be able to go, say, to, for instance, if they're a firefighter, go to their company and see their names organized by their rank and such. And if they died as part of a corporation, the same way. And Pataki has been more or less siding with Michael Arad, the designer, on this front, saying that they should be randomly organized. Arad said, you know, there was no hierarchy in terms of the way people died, and there should not be in the way the names are organized. But victims' families are very insistent on this point.
Well, you mentioned Pataki, and one last question to you. How political is this? There are some who are criticizing the governor, saying he's just trying to push through a plan before he leaves office in January.
Absolutely. There's a very strong sense that he's doing his best, and he's got a few months before he's out of office. He's trying very hard to make this happen. It would have a lot of weight if he does run, say, for national office, which many people are saying he is doing. At the same time, the Freedom Tower is another project. It looks like it's mired and possibly might not happen. And these are two projects he's hoping to get off the ground. And if the Freedom Tower doesn't happen, at least perhaps the memorial will happen before he leaves office.
Arun Venugopal from WNYC in New York. Arun, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
We turn now to Nikolai Orosov, architectural critic for the New York Times and an outspoken critic of the revised design. Nikolai, in your critic's notebook, you've called it gutted, a remarkable banality. Can you help us understand your feelings by describing the original design by architect Michael Arad and then this newest revision? The original design had two huge sort of voids, if you will, that you descended into?
Well, there were two voids that were supposed to represent the footprints of the former towers and a series of ramps that led down into these galleries that surrounded the voids, and the names were located down at the bottom of these pits.
We understand there was cascading water that someone described as the whispers of thousands of voices.
These kinds of things there have been 2 years now of refinements, redesigns. The waterfalls were in the original design that Mr. Arad proposed. But what's happened in this latest revision is the most important aspects of the design were removed, which is the idea of going down into these voids. It was a very long, drawn-out procession that led down into the voids where you finally discovered the names.
And you write that this is now, without this descent, a static composition of conventional reflecting pools. Some have said it's sort of like a corporate plaza. Mm-hmm. Why isn't it also, in your mind, architecture without that descent?
Well, there was a procession that was the key to the design that led you down into these voids, down deep into the site. They didn't lead down to bedrock, but the idea was that you had the experience of going down into these voids.
So it was the movement.
Where you then discovered the names. Once you bring the names up to the surface, right? Yeah. Then you've basically redesigned the project, and that's my problem with it. I mean, you're talking about something then that's a completely different design.
Well, what about the criticism that the architect became a part of the problem? A report in New York Magazine says city agencies and the firms that he worked with said he was alienating, impossible to work with, inexperienced, and he actually helped destroy his own design.
Well, I don't think that's fair. I mean, I'm not going to get into, you know, a discussion of Michael Arad's personality. That's irrelevant to me. The question is whether it's a better or worse design. I mean, what we're talking about really is whether you believe in the initial design or you don't. If you don't believe it, then hire someone else to redesign it.
Well, what about the costs? Originally slated to be, you know, above $300 million, but now ballooning up to almost $1 billion. Didn't the governor and the mayor have to make these drastic cuts in the design to save money?
Well, I don't think you can talk about the memorial. This is another issue here. You can't talk about the memorial unless you talk about its relationship to the Memorial Museum. And the money goes back to that. I mean, I think one of the things that's happened is the emphasis in terms of how the event will be remembered has shifted from the memorial, which keeps getting reduced in terms of its scale and its importance, and has shifted over to the Memorial Museum.
This is an add-on idea, sort of a box-like feature that came after the idea of just a memorial museum.
It's a museum that's 120,000 square feet, which is enormous, which will be underground, which is now the dominant part of the experience. Now, that's a very different way of remembering the suffering and the loss that happened there. You know, there's a discussion now about whether the names should be grouped according to their affiliation or not. And I think I think that's another step in a very dangerous direction, because one of the things that makes memorials the most powerful memorials work is the sense of anonymity. Because that's when you're allowed to experience, to join with those who've suffered in their experience of loss. It's an acknowledgement of the personal loss. It's a public acknowledgement of personal loss, which is very different than a gravesite. The second you start to group these people according to their affiliation, the company they work with, as firemen, as policemen, you start to create a system of hierarchies that I think takes away from the sense that this is a loss that's shared by all of us.
Nikolai Orsov, architectural critic for the New York Times, who wrote a scathing critique of the revised plan for the 9/11 World Trade Towers Memorial in his Critic's Notebook. And by the way, the period for the public to comment on the design ends today. We have a link at our website to weigh in and to see the revised plans. Go to here-now.org. That's HERE-NOW.org. And coming up, have you heard the rumors about a 9/11 conspiracy? That the American government might have been involved in bringing the Twin Towers down? Perhaps you think they're crazy, some scholars don't. We'll hear from the Chronicle for Higher Education about college professors who are weighing in on the 9/11 conspiracies. Stay with us, much more coming up here and now. Talking about the 9/11 terrorist attacks, have you heard the rumors? They've been circulating ever since the attacks that fundamentalist Muslim terrorists were not the ones who brought down the Twin Towers, that it was the U.S. government, maybe with missiles on board the planes. Maybe there were no planes at all. Maybe they were just holograms. Maybe the government brought the buildings down to launch the war they were itching to have. These sound crazy to some people, but in recent months, traffic to 9/11 conspiracy websites have surged. Why now? Well, according to a report in the Chronicle of Higher Education, of all places, one answer lies in the fact that a handful of scholars have gotten behind the movement. Joining us on the line is John Gravois, who wrote the article in the current Chronicle of Higher Education. And, John, you write about a group called Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Who are they?
They're a group of about 300 people, and I, at my count, about 50 of them are professors at universities. A handful of those are scientists, and they try to hold themselves to the questions of the physics of the building's collapse.
As opposed to some of the speculation about what might have been on the planes and some of the other conspiracies? Well,
sure. The planes as holograms and the missile pods underneath the wings of the planes. People in the movement have tried to rein those in, people in the 9/11 truth movement.
Well, the most prominent member of the Scholars for 9/11 truth who's looking at the science is this 57-year-old physicist from Brigham Young University. He's Stephen Jones, a Mormon, a former Bush supporter, who wrote about the topic of cold fusion. He's somewhat controversial on that level, but now he's saying what about 9/11?
He's saying that the buildings could not have fallen simply due to the being hit by planes. They had to have fallen in a controlled demolition. That the impact of the planes and the fires weren't enough to cause the buildings to fall down.
He points to what's become a very famous image in this world of 9/11 doubters. Are you call them? They're actually called 9/11 truthers, right?
Yeah, that's their term.
Yeah, there's one famous image. Tell us about that.
It's from the South Tower. It was right before the collapse. It was around the 82nd floor. There's this spew of yellow, hot, molten-looking stuff falling out of the building. And Dr. Jones from Brigham Young says that the buildings had to have been brought down, or his hypothesis is that the buildings were brought down by a substance called thermite, which is a mixture of aluminum powder and iron oxide that, when ignited, burns very, very, very hot, enough to melt even vaporized steel. And he says that spew coming out of the side of the building is actually a thermite reaction.
One of the reasons so many of these 9/11 truthers, again, as they call themselves, are gravitating to this theory is that they don't believe that the two buildings could have fallen so perfectly, or that a third building, which wasn't struck, could have fallen so perfectly. But you talked to a number of scientists who dismissed Professor Jones' claims. They say a lot of chemical reactions could have produced that yellow smoke that's in that photograph.
That's right. They say that it could be any number of things. Now, that's not to say that these other scientists have really taken up the issue with as much time and effort as Dr. Jones has. I think that's one interesting feature of this sort of non-debate going on between the 9/11 truth movement, the Scholars for 9/11 truth, and then the sort of scientific and scholarly community at large, is that they're really kind of talking past each other.
You also spoke to other members of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. There's former theologian David Ray Griffin. He wrote a book called The New Pearl Harbor. You went to a 9/11 conspiracy conference in Chicago earlier this month. 500 people attended. Also there was 9/11 Truth co-chair James Fetzer. He used to teach philosophy at the University of Minnesota in Duluth, but he's quit to work on this full time.
I think he retired 2 weeks before the conference.
You write about a single sentence in a think tank report. This was a report from the Project for the New American Century. It's the think tank of prominent neoconservatives. They wrote a 2000 report called Rebuilding America's Defenses. And conspiracy theorists point to one sentence in that as proof that the government wanted this to happen. Do you have that sentence?
I do.
Go ahead and read that.
The sentence is, "The process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor."
And how is that interpreted by 9/11 truthers?
Well, I suppose it's that they look at the last 5 years since 9/11 and they see revolutionary changes, and they see that they were all prompted by this pivotal event, 9/11.
John Gravois, how are these scholars who have, you know, joined this movement and in some ways, you know, are leading this movement, how are they treated on campus?
Stephen Jones at Brigham Young, when he came out with his paper, the physics department distanced itself from his work, and the School of Engineering at Brigham Young did likewise. But he says that there have been individuals in his department who've sort of joined his efforts.
Well, as you well know, John, this, you know, to a lot of people, this sounds absolutely insane and insensitive. But what do you think? Do you think these people, especially these scholars, do you think they're crazy?
I think they start out with a kind of skepticism that may be appropriate. You know, if you look at it in the abstract, here's this pivotal moment in American history that has had enormous consequences in American foreign policy, in American domestic policy, and here are scholars questioning the official story about it. That seems fair. But as you say, this doesn't just involve asking questions. This involves making allegations about the government, about elected leaders. It also involves not just asking questions, but proffering answers. And the answers that they arrive at are so sort of sensational that I think it means they have to be very invested in those answers. And the community of 9/11 truthers is at this point sort of cordoned off against skepticism from without. Mm. The people who believe in the official story haven't taken them seriously. And more, they're not taking people who believe in the official story seriously.
Who question them seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. So their certainty is multiplying. So we have our certainty, they have their certainty, and now it's really like we live in alternate universes.
John Gravois, staff reporter at the Chronicle for Higher Education. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WB.
Periodically on the program, we bring you stories of adult children taking care of aging parents. Today, a brother and sister. When their mother, Ruth Kane, suffered a stroke at the age of 84, she had many advantages that other senior citizens lacked. She had substantial assets, a loving son and daughter, and that son, a doctor, specialized in long-term care and aging. But even with all of these advantages, they say that during the last 3 years of Ruth Kane's life, spent in rehabilitation, assisted care facilities, and finally a nursing home, she suffered daily indignities, neglect, and unnecessary suffering. The son and daughter, Robert Kane and Joan West, have now written a book, part memoir, part teaching tool, about their mother's experience. It's called It Shouldn't Have to Be This Way, The Failure of Long-Term Care, and they join us to talk about it. Bob Kane in Minneapolis, welcome.
Thank you.
And Joan joins us from Long Island, New York. Joan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Bob, I want to start with you. Were you shocked that this is your field and you were still flummoxed by the process of caring for your mom?
Oh, I would say this experience for me was an epiphany. I mean, I've been doing research in this area for 30 years and thought I had, you know, the theories pretty well worked out. I've literally written papers and books about it. And when I had to confront it and actually see how hard it was to get people to adopt a problem-solving approach to practical caregiving, I was just flabbergasted.
Right. And Joan, not a doctor, but you had primary responsibility for your mother in her final years. I mean, you were the caregiver on the scene, whereas Bob might have been on the phone quite a bit. And we have talked about this on this program, but can you give us an idea, you know, just how difficult that is to be the person on the scene with the elderly parent?
Well, particularly in my mother's case, I describe the scenario as there's no such thing as a good day. Mm. On a really good day, I would go visit my mom in any one of the facilities, find her well, have a good visit, and shortly thereafter, I would get a phone call that she had developed an infection, was hysterical, was, you know, acting out or doing something. That was probably the best day. The worst day, of course, is when you go there and she's flailing out at you and attacking you and not quite knowing what's going on. And then there's the time when you don't go and you still feel guilty all day that you're not there.
Right. And then, you know, it's difficult to navigate what's it was even known terrain to you, Bob Kane. You've got some recommendations and they help explain the problem. You say that if somebody suddenly finds themselves in this position, they should first of all get a geriatric and elder care consultant and also a geriatric physician, not just a general practitioner. Tell us why.
My wife's mother was actually in Canada and had some problems with what turned out to be her gallbladder. The internists who were taking care of her basically dismissed her as just basically having dementia and complaining a lot. But we convinced our geriatric colleagues to take a closer look at her, found a reversible problem, and they treated her for that. And that part of her problems at least improved dramatically.
Mm. There were also many times, even with our mother, where her moods changes and her acting out would later be found to be tied to either a bronchial infection or very often a urinary tract infection that often went undiagnosed for a very long time until it was, you know, a highly acute situation.
Dr. Kaye, what can people do? It sounds as if the checklist that you'd have to have as you take a parent through this process would have to be pages long. How should people approach taking a parent through this?
Well, I think that there are different stages and different things you need to do. Certainly, in the hospital situation, people who don't have active advocates who are looking out for their well-being do not fare terribly well. Unfortunately, despite the fact that our modern hospitals are technologically sophisticated, they're not oriented to care for frail older people. When we're talking about people in more chronic care situations like assisted living and nursing homes, there you've got to choose very carefully and very wisely. It's important not only to go and visit the place, but to actually interview the staff who are going to be taking care of your parent. The people who you see at the front door, the people who take you on the tours, are more akin to the sales force than they are to the caregiving force.
This is an overburdened system. Everybody knows that. You write at one point, Bob, that if there were even one more aide.
That's what, yeah, that was because I got that from teaching, from the idea of the extra person, you know, the rolling sub, the permanent sub. If you have one person that is not assigned to a particular, in the school environment would be a class, so in a nursing home or an assisted living, it would be not assigned to a room or to a bunch of patients. This person is just what they call a permanent sub, available for emergencies, available to be a companion, to give aid to someone who needs it.
What Joan's describing is basically how you could purchase part of a person's time rather than having to buy your own private duty aide. I mean, the dilemma that families are in is when they need extra help, they're given no alternatives except to go out and purchase additional services in the form of a full-time aide,
But I can hear someone saying, who's going to pay? Where is the money for an already overburdened system to pay for more help for the increasing numbers of parents? I mean, we've been talking about the baby boomers approaching retirement. Their parents are approaching nursing homes.
Well, number one, we're already paying a huge amount of money to buy a product that nobody likes. I mean, we are spending literally hundreds of billions of dollars a year on a form of long-term care, namely the nursing home, that, you know, polls by the AARP and other organizations suggest that the vast majority of older people say they'd rather be dead than go into a nursing home. So let's start by saying, how do we take the resources we're already spending and redeploy those in a more creative way? Number two, if we took the people that are now working in long-term care, in nursing homes, assisted living, and actually use them in a more effective way, we could get much more care for the people, person hours that we're now investing. It may turn out that those resources are not sufficient to do everything that we want to do. And if they are, then we need to ask ourselves, you know, where are we better off investing money?
You know, you give specific details about nursing homes. For instance, you say even good nursing homes continue to build double rooms, despite growing evidence that most older people want a private room. That makes sense. And you point out that studies suggest that savings from the reduced infection rates that nursing homes would get with having people in single occupancy rooms would offset the cost of building them, that kind of thinking. But it feels as if, I mean, how do you make those, even those small changes in such a big system?
I think it's going to come partly out of public pressure, but partly we need to create in this country a whole sense of what I would call, you know, creative intolerance. Until there's a public outcry that says this is not the way that my parents should be treated and it's not the way I want to be treated when my time comes, we're going to continue to just sort of hum and haw and never really address the situation.
That's Robert Kane. He and his sister Joan West are co-authors of It Shouldn't Have to Be This Way, The Failure of Long-Term Care. Talks about the lessons they learned from the decline and ultimate death of their mom, Ruth Kane. Thank you both so much for putting together this book and talking about it.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Well, still to come, you can vote for the Scottish National Anthem. You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. We spoke recently with Jeff Howe, contributing editor for Wired magazine, about crowdsourcing, companies posting odd jobs and unsolved problems on websites so anyone who wants to can take them on and be paid a fee. Well, we wondered if salaried workers would worry about the competition. But one, Al Jeffries of Providence, Rhode Island, joined the crowd after our report. He writes, "Yes, always happen to listen, and today it paid off. I signed up for InnoCentive, the website that poses science challenges that companies can't solve in-house. I'm a hands-on laboratory research and development organic chemist who's invented materials which help to manufacture an earlier generation of microchips. And I've found some interesting organic chemistry problems posted on InnoCentive. The general public needs to know the effort needed to make any product based on chemistry is large. I've done laboratory chemistry R&D for many years, and I've solved practical problems. Yes, it is an embarrassment to have someone else come up with a winning idea, but the in-house people will ultimately be the ones who make the idea practical. If there were no competition and innovation, we'd still be using typewriters, rotary dial phones, slide rules, and watching black and white TVs." Well, we also have this update on reporter Alan Cockle's story about the controversial use of electric shocks on children with behavioral disorders at the Judge Rotenberg Educational Center here in Canton, Massachusetts. A proposed ban on those treatments failed in the Massachusetts State House. However, opponents of the treatments still hope for a legislative compromise. They say the treatments are inhumane and unnecessary. Well, Bern Smith, listening on the Internet in St. Catharines, Ontario, Canada, agrees. He writes, "I work at a treatment group home in Canada and have come to learn through experience that there are always alternatives to explore when working with children or the disabled. There have been a number of times when I would have loved to use electric shocks to bring an unruly child into line. The motivation for this option, were it ever to be available to me, would have been to make my job easier. But easy doesn't always translate into most effective or count as reasonable. The bottom line is that frontline work with these populations is undervalued and severely underpaid in our society. Standards like requiring completed post-secondary education, ongoing training, and paying a livable wage need to be addressed. I believe that then, treatment utilizing punishment to alter behaviors may be unnecessary." Well, Kyle Larson also listens on the web in Elkins Park, Pennsylvania, and wrote after our talk with Paul Rykoff, author of Chasing Ghosts, A Soldier's Fight for America from Baghdad to Washington. Paul said Iraqis and U.S. troops used the word Alibaba to refer to the bad guys. But Kyle writes, "My recollection of the story of Alibaba and the 40 thieves is that Alibaba is the hero of the story who outwits the thieves. He's not the bad guy. He's the good guy." And lastly, we spent some time last week with Calvin Trillin, deadline poet for The Nation magazine and critic of the Bush administration's waging of the war in Iraq. Many of you appreciated it. Matt Curry of Glendale, Arizona, did not. He sent the following poem in response to Calvin's work. We share it with you with the help of Matt Odette, board op and mix master extraordinaire. Hit it, Matt.
"Heard you talking with Calvin Trillin, and I must say it was less than thrilling, making Bush out to be the villain. What left-wing Kool-Aid has he been swilling? He tried to stop W's second four by ranting about the Iraq war. He doesn't recognize the score. We're fighting terror on either shore. Poor Calvin is a bad excuse. A poet's pushing rhyme abuse. His poetic license is fast and loose. I'd rather hear from Dr. Seuss. I think it would be too bizarre for you to read this on NPR. I know just what my chances are, 'cause I'm no high-priced poet star."
Oh, Matt Curry, yes you are. I don't know how to stop talking like this. That was our own Matt Odette. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, letters@here-now.org, or you can give us a call, leave a message, 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. More ahead. I can't do it. Here and Now. Imagine if you had the chance to pick the national anthem for the United States. Would you have selected the Star-Spangled Banner? Well, people in Scotland are getting an opportunity to pick their anthem. The Royal Scottish National Orchestra is holding a vote this month on 5 songs. One of them will become Scotland's new national anthem. Joining us from a BBC studio in London is the chair of the RSNO, Tom Thompson. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
And, you know, first question, and I'm not sure if it's a touchy one, but although it has a tremendous heritage, Scotland isn't a country as such. So why a national anthem?
Well, the UK, the Great Britain and Northern Ireland, obviously has God Save the Queen as the national anthem. But a lot of people in Scotland feel that we should have a song as well. We'd use God Save the Queen, but also something for Scottish national occasions. We might like to have a separate song and a separate anthem.
Yeah, and you do use Flowers of Scotland, we understand. It's by Roy Williamson of the Corries.
We use that typically at football and rugby matches.
Yeah, it's sort of an unofficial anthem. We're listening to it now. Beautiful song. It was written in 1966. Some of the lyrics, we can still rise now and be the nation again that stood against him, Proud Edward's army. And what, you know, what is it? What does this song have going for it?
Well, it's rousing lyrics. It's already got some appeal in Scotland because, as I say, it's the main song sung at football and rugby matches. So people have got used to it.
By the way, you know, as we listen to more of the music, how do people vote? I mean, you know, my late uncle is the wonderful Lachlan McLaughlin. Would I have a vote because I'm part Scottish?
Yes, it's open really to anybody in the world. If you go to our website, which is www.rsno.org.uk, then you can listen to the music and you can then vote. And we've had votes, thousands of votes from all over the world, from lots from America and Canada, but as far away as Libya, Christmas Island, Mongolia, China, and I think every country in Europe, we've had people voting, plus, of course, many, many people in Scotland.
Why? Now, why did you open up to people who aren't Scottish?
Well, we wanted to take the pulse of the world. I think the main voters are expatriate Scots. As you probably know, Scots have a very wide diaspora across the world, and a lot of Scots abroad particularly feel very Scottish and very interested in the culture of Scotland. So I suspect the majority of the votes have been either people with relatives connected with Scotland or expatriate Scots.
Well, let's listen to more of the songs that are the candidates. They vary widely from the music to the subject matter to even when they were written. Here's another one. This is with the words of Robert Burns, 1793, and a traditional folk tune. How would you pronounce this? I think the translation is Scots Wahey.
Scots Wahey.
Let's listen to them. Now, Tom Thompson with the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. Robert Burns has lyrics to 2 of the songs that are candidates, and his words, well, can be, bloody, gory. The word bled is in here.
Yes.
You know, but beloved.
Well, Scots Wahey is really the words, it's the form of a speech by Robert the Bruce before he defeated the English army at Bannockburn in 1314. So it is fairly bloody, yes.
And yet, what do you think that song will have going for it?
Again, it's rousing. People like rousing songs. But it's not really as commonly used as some of the other of the 5 candidates.
And by the way, the battles that you speak of, the wars of Scottish independence, many in the States saw dramatized in the movie Braveheart, which you had to have a brave heart to go see.
It was
tough in some ways. Well, let's keep going. A Man's a Man also has lyrics by Burns. Let's listen.
Oh,
Would you do me the favor of speaking some of these words that we're hearing?
Well, it's called A Man's a Man for All That. And it's really Burns' tribute to the common man of Scotland. And this, in fact, was sung at the opening of the Scottish Parliament in 1999. Now, you might be interested that the idea for this contest came from Simon Woods, whom we recruited last year from the New Jersey Symphony Orchestra, where he was president and chief executive. So we brought some American thinking, I think, back to Scotland.
Well, some of the words of A Man's a Man is there for honest poverty that hangs his head and that. I don't know if I'm doing it justice. The coward slave, we pass him by, we dare be poor for that. And I'm wondering, you know, I'm thinking of some of the words in our anthem. Oh, say, can you see? It's not the way people speak now. Is this the way someone might speak in Scotland?
Very few people these days. But I think the tune is a very important part of it. It's how rousing the tune is.
Hmm. Another candidate, Scotland the Brave, lyrics by Cliff Hanley in 1950, but much older music. What is the music?
It's a traditional bagpipe tune.
Let's listen. Tom Thompson, I bet this one is getting a lot of votes because it's so recognisable.
It is, and this is the one that Scotland used when we won gold medals at the Commonwealth Games in Australia this year. Mm. So it got a lot of publicity and a lot of airtime.
Well, we have one last candidate. That's Highland Cathedral, lyrics by Ben Kelly. Though originally an instrumental from German composers, it was written in 1982. Let's listen. Beautiful lyrics. Land of our fathers, we will always be faithful and loyal to our own country. In times of danger, we will set you free, lead you to glory and to victory.
This was used by Madonna at her wedding in Scotland to the film director Guy Ritchie. So again, it's well known.
You know, because a girl from Detroit should have a Scottish anthem at her wedding. Tom Thompson, thank you so much and good luck to you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Tom Thompson, chair of the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. You can go to our website to find out how to vote for Scotland's new national anthem as we listen to the candidates. I don't know about you, but we are all standing. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the new